All right, who remembers what community virtue did we discuss last week? Gratitude. And did anyone think of good ways or potentially creative ways to put flesh on the bones of that this particular week? You don't need to tell us any good deeds you did, but what sorts of things can, as a community, what sorts of actions and practices might we do tangibly that would help reinforce that virtue?
Appreciating the presence of others.
Okay, appreciating the presence of others. Good. And Jerry, what are some ways we might make that known, that we appreciate it?
We value them. We value what they represent and what they do and how we can observe and, if possible, imitate those things.
Good. Very good. Anything else? Good. I've put many people to that test in my own life. So, very good. So, seeking, I think, in a very true way, to find what is honorable and praiseworthy in people, and to note and focus on those things. Right. I think all of us. Maybe not all of us, but our tendency is to find the irritant, right, the thing that bothers us, and that becomes what we tend to hone in on. And the more you do that, the more obvious it becomes, right? The more obvious the irritation becomes, and the more irritated you become, and the less loving and the less able to see those things that God really is doing in someone's life. But if we are noting, you know, that which is praiseworthy in somebody, those things that are honorable, even if they have other glaring flaws, we tend to be able to have more of a disposition of being able to overlook graciously some of those other things that aren't as noble. What else? Yeah, good. So Anita said to take someone's place. If you've noticed that they have just been faithfully doing something over a long period of time, to join in with them as a sign of gratitude, to say, I'm thankful that you've been so giving in this regard. Let me now join in to what you've been doing and help kind of send them into early retirement. No, that's I got a quick email this week. Someone here was listening last week, for which I am very grateful, and got a quick email from someone that said, hey, I've been doing this for a while, but I just got an email this week from somebody telling me how thankful they were that I've been doing it. And the person receiving the email wasn't in the Sunday school class, but they said, someone must have been listening, because I got, so whoever that was, kudos, good job for taking note. But yeah, just trying to be people who are A, perceptive, that notice what other people are giving, and then making note of it, letting them, acknowledging to them that you're grateful that they're part of what's going on communally. And as we said, I think a way that we do that as a body, the kind of easy way, or a way that we've at least had a practice of doing, is in our annual celebrations and feasts, to make those ways of marking God's faithfulness to us as a body, to us as individual Christians, but also to express thanksgiving for one another. Those really are times to come together and kind of reflect and soak in on the fact that, okay, this is God's gift to me to be a part of this community, and these particular people have been a big part of my own formation or have shown faithfulness in all of these other ways. So, you know, keep thinking through those things, and hopefully more than just thinking through them, you know, putting them into practice, no matter how forced it may feel at first, or strange or foreign to your normal way of acting. And we do want to see those things just to become a normal part of our practice, just being a grateful community. Well, this morning, we want to take up the virtue of fidelity or promise keeping. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the movement that took place some years ago, the Promise Keepers movement. But the idea, you know, and that's a little bit different than what we're talking about this morning, but the reality that undergirds all of this is that we do have a promise-keeping God, right? A big part of what we hold as dear as a Reformed church is that God makes covenants with us. And those covenants, at the base of them all, is the character and promise of God, that He is faithful. So when the Lord reveals Himself, even in the book of Exodus, He says, you know, I'm the Lord, that He's, you know, faithful, that He's abounding in steadfast love and kindness, that He is faithful to what? 1,000 generations. That a key part of His character, part of what gives us hope as Christians, is that we know that He is what? The same today, yesterday, and forever. That the God we meet with today isn't going to do a quick 180 tomorrow, you know, like me if I miss a meal or two. I'm a completely different human being if you walk in the house. That God doesn't have those kind of personality changes, that you know that you'll meet the same God 20 years from now as you know today, that He's going to be there and be consistent. Well, if we are made in the image of God, and if part of our redemption is to be remade in the image of Christ, to begin to reflect what God is like, promise-keeping or being faithful is something that not only individually, but as a community, should be part of what reflects or reflects from us or binds us together. I'm sure you've heard, you don't hear this as much anymore, but in maybe my parents' generation, grandparents, you know, a man's word is what? His bond. You don't hear that too much anymore. Why might that be? Why might our culture not have a high value for things like faithfulness or fidelity, at least as a cultural virtue that's kind of promoted and talked about often? What sorts of things may have tainted our view of faithfulness or someone, when someone says something, you know they're going to do it? Okay, disappointment. Sure, but what sorts of things have caused that disappointment culturally? What sort of things are pretty common to us that make, you know, when people say something, we think, eh, they may or may not be telling the truth? Politics. Yeah, politics is a big one. I mean, even the people we're rooting for, they say stuff that we know deep down, like, they're never going to do that, right? And instead of looking at it as like, you know, that's a real one mark on their character, but a disservice to us as a nation. You know, they make the promises, like the kid in eighth grade that, you know, when he's running for class president, it's like, you know, we're going to have a two-hour lunch. And you know, we get those from our politicians, and we know full well that's not happening. But we just say, well, that's just politics, right? And, you know, it sounds good. It'll make for a good soundbite. And the main thing is that the other guy doesn't win, you know. Well, you get in a milieu like that long enough, and that has effects culturally. What other avenues of speech have caused us to distrust people's words? Well, yeah, experience with other humans does does definitely taint that. But that's existed forever. But things like, as a what's that? Yeah, I mean, that definitely is another thing that has impacted this, and we'll talk about that. Social media or things like advertising. I mean, you know, how many times have you seen advertised on TV, you know, a particular hamburger, and then you order it, and you're like, this looks nothing like what that picture was on TV. Or the lady eating it, you know, or what. You know, if you drink Bud Light, your beach parties will all look like this. You know, things are promised to us in advertising that we know full well they can't fulfill. How many of you saw the lawsuit that happened about a year and a half, 2 years ago, where someone sued Red Bull because the slogan is Red Bull gives you wings? And, you know, after making use of it, the reality was it did not give them, this was a real lawsuit, and they were given a settlement, oddly enough. But we have built into our mentality, we laugh and we say, well, of course Red Bull doesn't give you wings, because that's the normal way people advertise. They sell you something that you know they can't perform on. But we have taken it as, well, that's just the way it is. And therefore, words, what we speak, has become cheapened when a lot of what we're getting through television, whether it be our politicians or the advertising that comes in, or just how things are even presented, you know, you can present a life that isn't true on social media and so forth, that we have become accustomed to and very kind of at home with, well, so-and-so said that and didn't mean it. That's just the way things are. As opposed to being appalled by it, which used to be the way things were, you know. Well, so-and-so said he was going to do it, and he didn't do it, and the whole community would kind of shake their heads like, well, guess he's not going to be a plumber in this town very long, you know. But now it's like, well, he'll find another customer and, you know, just ignore all the bad ratings on Yelp or whatever. Even in our current culture, as was mentioned, our most significant promises have been given pretty easy ways out. So in California, what is our marriage law? Or let's say divorce law. No fault, which means you don't have to have a good reason, which kind of cheapens the vows you take, right? You take a vow, and then the law that undergirds the vow, at least by the state, says you can break this for just any old reason you want. There doesn't have to be a legitimate reason. Well, that really undermines the very vows you take. You can't hold those two things together, which is interesting, that we make a law about a marriage that we're sanctioning saying those vows mean nothing when you take them. Feel free to release yourself from them at any time when convenient. Well, you know, when we start doing that with our most weighty commitments, like marriage, when that becomes something that we say that can be once I'm unhappy or once things aren't working out. And again, we'll talk about there are legitimate reasons for divorce. There are legitimate reasons to break those vows. But those should be just that, the exception that is painful when taken. Not something that we're, you know, it's just kind of common. Everyone says, well, of course. Or even at the wedding, people are, you know, kind of adding up, well, how long do you think this is going to last? Which, you know, hopefully is not happening in Christian marriages, but is very much a cultural kind of a view and disposition. You know, contracts that we make presently typically have built into them, especially if you have enough lawyers and you're a big enough corporation, where there's always a release clause that will cover you, and you know the indemnification will be sufficient to make sure that you aren't the one holding the bag at the end of things. And again, these are things that really have kind of eroded a culture of promise making and keeping, or being really bound or faithful to the words that we've spoken. And yet, even though that's true, all of us know that there are exceptions to that rule, and when we see it, it's a beautiful thing, right? It does still moves us when we see people who are faithful to what they've said, people who do very hard things that you even look at and say, I'm not sure I could do it. I'm not sure I could stick it out just because it's the right thing to do. But when we see it, it really still, again, moves our humanity. As Lewis Smead writes in reference to that, we see people who choose not to quit when the going gets rough simply because they promised to see it through. They stick to lost causes. They hold on to a love that's grown cold. They stay with people who have become pains in the neck. If you have a ship you will not desert, if you have people you will not forsake, if you have causes that you will not abandon, listen to this, then you are like God. And that's the key here. You know, God remains faithful when what? When we're faithless, right? And we often operate on a this for that scale, right? I will be faithful, I mean, as long as you are, right? Or I'll keep my end if you keep your end. But there is something to be said when things don't go the way you expected in a marriage or in business, and you still do what you said that you would do. Because in doing that, You are a reflection of the God who is constantly being faithful to people who have not kept their side of the bargain. As we've mentioned, God is a covenant God. Being faithful is part of how part of who He is and how He relates to us, and therefore it needs to be part of how we relate to one another. Margaret Farley writes this, and I think if we think about it in these terms, it's helpful, because I think a lot of times we think, oh, promise making or promise keeping. We think of kind of the big things, you know. We take membership vows or ordination vows or, you know, marriage vows. And there are these very formal promises we make that do ratchet it up a bit. I mean, that's part of why we take vows. It's this extra binding of yourself to something. But the reality is we make all sorts of promises that aren't formal. And most of life, as far as how healthy it is or isn't, is people keeping those unspoken promises. Margaret Farley writes this: "The history of the human race, as well as the story of any one life, might be told in terms of commitments. At the heart of this history lies a sometimes hidden narrative of promises, pledges, oaths, compacts, committed beliefs, and projected visions." I mean, promises are one of those things that undergird our relationships and are hardly noticed until what? Yeah, we only tend to notice the negative aspect of it when it's glaringly absent or it's broken. Then we're like, oh, this is wrong, right? But we rarely acknowledge it as, man, do you see how good this is, that this person's still doing the right thing after all these years, or still being faithful. But, I mean, things as simple as, you know, we've talked about, you know, bringing the weekly snack when your name's on the list, that's part of promise keeping, right? And again, because the snacks are sitting on the table right now, we won't notice. But if they weren't here, I mean, at least the kids would notice. I don't. And the guy who has to clean up after would definitely notice and probably give thanks. He'd go back to the gratitude week. You know, but picking up, you know, kids from school, if you're carpooling, getting up daily and going to work and, you know, paying the utility bill that your children may never realize is like, you know, that's faithfulness day after day. Until, of course, they're doing it themselves. Then they can look back and reflect on the fact of, man, that's not easy to just do something over. But why do people do it? You know, why do moms and dads consistently do things that aren't necessarily glamorous or even enjoyable at some points in life, right? Sometimes in life you get to a spot in your vocation where you don't want to do it anymore. And in our current generation, it's like, well then you have to quit because you're not being self-fulfilled. But the one who says, even though I don't want to do it, and I will keep doing it for 20 years, because I have promises to keep to my wife and my children, that is really what undergirds, you know, as Margaret Farley was saying, human history. That's what makes lives go round. And starting to take stock of that and think of how we interact with that is very powerful in a community. Let me ask this. Yes, Jerry.
Is it correct to say we are increasingly creative liars?
I mean, I don't know. If you read history, we've always been pretty creative. But I think what has changed is we're no longer appalled when the lies come out. I mean, that's mainly the big difference. People have always been corrupt. It's just there was a societal shame that came with it, that when that is removed, it definitely emboldens our practice toward the negative. I mean, think of the opposite. If we kind of just all fatigue, if no one can be counted on, what does that do to a community? Like, just in tangible ways, what would that do? What's that? It falls apart. Okay. So, you know, if you say, hey, I'm going to schedule this event, you know, and three people come to you and say, you know what I'd really like to do? We'd like to do this. And the ladies get to go, okay, this, you know, so-and-so said they want to do this. And they put the hard work in to do it. And then the three that planned it are the ones that show up. what does that do? Yeah, you begin to shrink back and just say, yeah, I'm not going to put myself out there in upholding, you know, these duties if this other side of the bond that, again, is unspoken but expected, especially, you know, and I used to have this joke was like, you know, whoever says they want this new study will not attend. That used to be, you know, like, what we need a youth group. And then, you know, okay, we'll go through our, we start a youth group. And sure enough, the people who suggested it never come to the youth group. You think, what in the world? Like, how in the world? So, I mean, you can shrink back, or I've just decided, like, okay, we need to decide if we actually want to do this. And if we do, we got to just do it and not be frustrated when, you know, maybe the person that suggested doesn't come. Now, that said, there are plenty of things that people do here that if we don't show them the honor of keeping our part, and again, this isn't saying, well, you need to go to everything, you need, but if there is a interaction that makes it seem that you want to be counted on for something, if we fail in those commitments over and over, it really does tear at the fabric of a community and makes it to where people, again, just kind of say, well, I'm going to sit back and wait for someone else to step up over and over because I'm tired of being burned in one way or another. You know, no one's going to want to start the project if they know that by the end of it, it will be their project and not a group project if that's how it began. You know, the reality is promises set up expectations that then direct people's lives. So you make a promise to someone, and that has a real impact because someone now changes or directs their future based on what you've said. Now, that may not seem like a big deal, but think about that. You've spoken words, they have been heard, and now in the will of the person hearing them, they're changing the direction of what they're going to do based on your spoken promise or your commitment. And if you're not there in the future to where you've promised to be, that really does tear relationally. We arrange things like our behavior, our calendar. You know, you mark the dates. I'm marking these ones off because so-and-so said we're doing this. You say no to certain other options, right? Because someone has made a promise, you make arrangements. And if we senselessly break those agreements, what's the result? What sorts of feelings are caused? Good. Distrust. What else? Yeah, resentment. Feelings of betrayal, right? You know, like, I thought I could count on you. I mean, it does real human damage. I think a lot of times we think like, well, what's the big deal? That's part of the problem of the thinking of the person doing it. What's the big deal is you can't get inside the mind of the other person and realize the big deal that it is inside of them and the turmoil that is causing them and so forth. Think about what you're doing when you're making a promise. You are voluntarily, and there's all kinds of philosophy written on this, and it is a fascinating study, but you're voluntarily obligating yourself to perform some future course of action. So you're saying, as you look out in this unformed future, you're concretely saying there's going to be this form when we get there, if at all possible, right? If the Lord wills and the creek don't rise. If we get there, this is the shape that will be there when we get there. And again, that is a God-like quality that he's given man. Now, the problem is we are finite and we can't direct the future. But promise making is our best human attempt to say, when we get to that future, here's what you can count on me doing when we get there. We reach out and put a shape into time and space and say, when we arrive there at this time, I will be there doing these things. And those intentions often do shape the future, right? I mean, look at you who are still married after, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. you made a promise, you know, those many years ago, and here you are, and you look at each other and you say, well, wouldn't you know it? The future that we promised would be is here, you know, for better or worse. But that is a powerful thing, something that is very unique to humanity. And if that is undone, it begins to unravel our humanity. Promise-keeping is a part of our own personal integrity. And if we lose or the ability or the willingness to keep our word, we lose a part of ourself. You know, you really do lose bonds that should be there with other people, but you lose your own integrity. Now, with all that said, well, because we're human, we know what are the potential complications with promise making? Okay, unforeseen circumstances. Good, we're going to get to that. It's perfect. What else? Yeah, human frailty, just inability. So unforeseen circumstances, at times there's just inability, and we'll talk about that as well.
Unwillingness.
Yeah, unwillingness, our own feelings. We'll get into that. That's a bad one. Yeah, for sure, we can say it and not mean it. But what about when we make a promise, we genuinely mean it, we want to fulfill it, what kind of complications are there? So we've got unforeseen circumstances arise, or just inability to accomplish what we wanted to accomplish, you know, our finitude. When you're promising, who are you engaging with? Another person. So there's also the possibility of misunderstanding or unrealistic expectation concerning the promise, which is also an issue. So notice, as we hear this, and we'll see this in all of these, we think like, yeah, you know, so-and-so gave his word and he doesn't keep it. But there's also a responsibility as a promisee to not be unrealistic, to not expect more than a human can give, or not to hold someone to something that you know is impossible, or to pressure them into making commitments that they shouldn't be making. Now, there's a lot that's also a lot of the onus also goes on the one receiving a promise. So, unforeseen circumstances, for instance, you know, you've promised, hey, we're going to meet up and go to the movies on Friday. Haven't seen each other in a while. I will be there. And then you get a call at 5 and you say, you know, my child is in the hospital. I can't make it. You have one of two choices. The normal communal choice at that point is a much higher need has outranked the promise given. There are other promises this person made. And one of those promises to this child, right, that's built into the relationship. And the ranking of that commitment outranks this one. Or you can say, they just cancel on me all the time, and I'm hurt about it, right? You have a choice there. And so we want to be realistic receivers of promises, saying people can't always keep their word because of unforeseen circumstances. Now, again, that's different than saying at 5 o'clock, hey, so-and-so is having a party, and that sounds more fun to me, and so I'm not going to be able to make it to the movies. Now, those are the kind of things that the reason you make or give your word is to actually set yourself to say no to a whole bunch of other things that might be better. And that's tough in our culture. It's interesting. They've even done studies on it, especially now with the rise of texting. Young people do not make plans typically until the very last second. And they say that the young people will say, and they've done studies in two ways, well, we do it because you can make the plan at the last second because of this form of communication. We can all get in touch with each other. But when asked personally why they did it, they also said, because of that form of communication, you never know when a better thing might come. And so, because all of us can be in contact all the time, I know I can secure this plan with my close friends at the end if that's all that's there. But I'll wait because something else might jump in, you know, so-and-so might text me at 6:30 and I want to keep that option open as well. Well, a part of giving your word is saying, this means I'm also going to have to say no to other things. And so in both regards, unforeseen circumstances, yes, there is a ranking of our word. And there are times where you keep your word to your own hurt. And there are times where you say, as much as I was sincere when I made that promise, this thing now obligates me to such an extent I must break it in order to be faithful. And there's the difference. The question is fidelity still at the core of your choosing? Because I want to be faithful, I must break my word is far different than because I want to have a better time, I'm going to break my word. Do you understand the moral difference there as far as, you know, there really is a time when things outrank one another? And the other thing that has to be there is, if I could keep my word to you, if that was an option, I would. And also the feeling of, what can I do to make amends or satisfy this obligation that I'm unable to meet at present? So, you know, and again, that can go with financial obligations and a myriad of other things. But there should be this willingness that I still want to be faithful, even though I can't do it at the time appointed. How might I continue in faithfulness by, you know, either making other plans or continuing, etc.? And then there's just our own finitude, where we try to keep a promise, but it doesn't always, we can't always accomplish it because of our lack of either ability or time, etc. The lack of time one. Again, this is both promisee and promiser. There are certain people that have a hard time saying what? No. And if you know that, and you keep having people bind themselves to things, you're part of the problem with their lack of fidelity. You know that they have this desire, and they have a sincere desire. I mean, we've had people in this community, you know, there are certain men and women that I just think, like, how do they do it all, you know? I remember, we'll turn the thing off, when Brock was interning here, and he's, you know, building this person's deck and studying for this Bible study and finishing seminary and watching the kid, you know, and he's got so many things, and you think, how in the world? And yet they keep saying yes to things. You know, there comes a point where we need to see people who have that tendency and help evaluate with them, is this wise for you to take on this particular responsibility? Is there someone else that I can go to with this particular need, and not, you know, keep wearing out, you know, the same individuals, as well as the party having responsibility of their own person, trying to say, do I really have time to fulfill this good obligation that I'm about to say yes to? And to be careful with our yeses, you know, again, not stingy with them, but at the same time, not so frivolous with them that they don't really become yeses. We say yes, but we can't accomplish it, and therefore it's not really giving our word, that we need to be wise enough to know our own abilities, time, and priorities for commitment. Real quick, I want to deal with, finally, and then we'll maybe cover some more next week. Not next week, but next time we get together. What are some of the things in our culture that conflict with promise-keeping? What are some of the things that our culture values or impresses upon us, or we feel pressure for, or that are just devolved from the right, that are no longer virtues but vices? What things in our culture have the potential to misshape our ability to be promise keepers or faithful? Individualism, and the height of that, of course, is self-actualization, meaning personal freedom, doing what we want, right? And doing it when we want, and how we feel being a final dictator of what we do. I mean, notice, if feelings are what are going to dictate everything, you can't make a promise about anything. I mean, how many times as a parent, the last thing you want to do is deal with your children or change a diaper or get up and feed someone. You know, feeling is not going to cut it for the long haul. There are going to be days you don't feel like loving your husband or loving your wife, and that doesn't keep you from the obligation. If feelings are going to dictate, that's just never going to work as far as promises are concerned. But the other things promises do that interfere with that is they limit our freedom. Promises limit your choices. If you said, right, I promise to be faithful to you and to no other, you've just said every other woman in the world is off limits. You've limited your choices severely. and that's a noble thing. But in a culture that says, well, we don't want limits, well, that's very difficult, again, to live up to those things. But even saying, yes, we will come to your house for Thanksgiving, well, you've just limited all of your invitations down to that one. And then when the other one comes in, you know, the week of Thanksgiving, he's like, oh, man, that party is going to be way more fun than this one. promise keeping is saying, well, this is the commitment. Like, you know, we know Uncle Joe's the worst, but we're going to go sit with him anyway. You know, that is part of what makes this difficult culturally. They have noticed, interestingly, that with RSVPs in the present day, there's the same issue. Now, this is something that is a problem for us as a church, but it's a problem for us because we're completely caught up with the culture on this issue. RSVPs used to mean I'm going to warn you ahead of time of an event coming, and you are going to warn me ahead of time whether you're coming or not. And for preparation's sake, for expectation's sake, for a whole host of things. Well, it used to be a lengthy time limit for where you would give an answer early, so you would give time to prepare, has now become, if you respond at all, it's like 2 days before, which doesn't help. I mean, you RSVPing, you know, at 8:45 and the party's at 9 doesn't do a thing for the host, right? Or not RSVPing at all and then saying, well, our intention is to go. Now, again, these things have become so common to us that we think, well, what's the big deal? It's not a big deal unless you're the person planning it. And if that happens enough, what will happen? People just say, I'm over it. It's impossible to know how this is going to come out. And you do that enough, and I'm just tired. I'll let someone else try to guess how many people are coming. And again, as a community, to just sheer kindness and love is to take those steps and say, how can I be more faithful in this regard so that your acts of faithfulness are not looked on with disdain? Because that's how it feels, again, to the person who's trying, again, to be faithful and putting themselves out in service. You know, starting something and not finishing. A few other things. Other cultural conflicts. We have a consumer mentality, which means making commitments is often based on the best product available. We choose this and we mean it until the next better thing comes out. Well, if we begin to do that with institutions, there's always going to be something to move our loyalties. Or if we do it with spouses, like, well, you were great, you know, but look, I've met this other person and they're great too. Well, it doesn't work that way. You know, if you are going to have in your mind a consumer mentality, there's always a better church to go to, a taller, more handsome husband with a better job, you know, a more beautiful wife, a better city to live in. There's always something better, and that will always move your loyalties. And again, we just need to be aware that these are things that are potential temptations. Again, changing something is not always wrong. Changing churches is not always wrong. Okay, moving is not always wrong. But asking yourself, as you're doing it, what are my motivations for doing that? And letting other people speak to you about your place in the community and maybe checking your motives and so forth. We let our feelings dictate. We've talked about that. And we lead somewhat transient lives. I think an interesting one is that we're also suspect of institutions. There's this twofold thing that goes on in our culture where institutions are always looked at with a bit of disdain. You know, they're corrupt. You know, the church is corrupt and government's corrupt. So we have a disdain for them, and then we have unrealistic expectations of them on the flip side. The church is corrupt, and why isn't our church perfect? Like, well, which one is it? You know, and instead of having realistic expectations, the church is fallible, and thankfully, you know, ours is doing its best in these particular areas, versus, you know, it's the worst thing, and it also better be 100% perfect. Those don't jive together. You can't live like that. And no one in a community can survive with those sorts of expectations. Well, there is, unfortunately, a lot more to cover, but no more time to do it. So we will pretend to introduce next week's by finishing this week. Well, anyway, whenever we come back together a few weeks from now, the 8th. Hopefully can put some more flesh on the bones. Let's pray for time's sake, and then we'll go to worship.